June 2011. This month in Control System Security, I talk with Dylan Beresford and Rick Moy of NSS Labs. We discuss Dylan's recently discovered Siemens vulnerabilities. Exactly what are they and what don't we know yet? Then I'm joined by Rick Kahn of Matricon/Honeywell Analytics. Rick and his open letters are my go-to source for what's going to happen next in NERC SIP standards. All that and more this month in Control System Security. This month in Control System Security is brought to you by Schweitzer Engineering Labs, SEL Cybersecurity Solutions, sensible, manageable, scalable at selinc.com/cybersecurity, and by a new sponsor, Nitro Security Inc. Nitro Security is an active SCADA and industrial control system security research firm and the makers of the NitroView Security Information and Event Management System. It's a specialized security and compliance console designed for operations across enterprise, supervisory, and control system networks. Learn more at nitrosecurity.com. And by Waterfall Security Solutions, security for industrial control networks at www.waterfall-security.com. Joining me on the podcast now is Dylan Beresford and Rick Moy. They're both with NSS Labs. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hi, Dale.
Dylan, you've become quite famous lately with some of the Siemens vulnerabilities, although I know you've done other work in this area. And let's start with that. Let's help our listeners understand a little bit more about your background. What kind of experience did you bring to this Siemens work that you did in ICS and ICS security?
So, again, at the end of the day, right, a vulnerability is a vulnerability. I mean, it's no different than a vulnerability in, say, for instance, a browser or, say, for instance, a file format function. I just basically look at software, right, and hardware, looking for sort of mistakes that are made by developers when they're in the process of designing these products. If I find a vulnerability, I figure out a way to leverage that to take control of that device or that software somehow. So that's kind of the curiosity factor is really what drives me when I'm doing this. And it doesn't matter, again, if it's really SCADA or if it's HMI, if it even entirely means critical infrastructure in general. I mean, if I find a vulnerability, I want to exploit it, right? That's sort of what I do as a hobby, and I also do that professionally here at NSS Labs.
Okay, and then what kind of resources did you have available when you were looking for these vulnerabilities in Siemens?
$2,000 in cash and a router, a switch, and a couple of PLCs that I bought from PLCtrainer.net.
So you just had a home network with, what, a couple of, were they S7-1200 PLCs and a switch and some computers?
That's correct, and a debugger and Metasploit.
I think that's important because there was kind of this misnomer that a lot of people have already picked up on in one of the Siemens announcements that you had special laboratory conditions. So it was, I mean, I'm not sure too many attackers would spend $2,000 just casually out of that.
Right.
Is that work that, Rick, that NSS supports?
Yeah, absolutely. So NSS Labs is an independent information security testing and analysis firm. So our mission in life here is really to help owners and buyers of IT security products, you know, understand what they're buying, how to best implement it to protect the assets that they have. And that means whether or not they're data center servers, client PCs, remote offices, or industrial control systems, which is a rather new area that we were looking to get involved in because of its importance to critical infrastructure. So there's a number of things that you can look at: the effectiveness of a security product, the vulnerabilities in the target systems that are actually used, and vulnerability research, as it's more broadly known, is something that Dylan brings a lot of expertise in. And so he's done a really a fantastic job of taking a a white hat hacker approach to these PLCs. We think it's very important to understand, particularly because of the way that systems are deployed, which is often not air-gapped or whatnot.
So the $2,000 that he talked about, was that NSS Labs funding to do that work?
Yes. We'll, from time to time, look in different areas that we're expanding our research activities, and the $2,000 was, a modest investment. I think what's notable about the sum is you said most attackers wouldn't spend $2,000. And I think that's probably true for your script kiddies and your general run-of-the-mill kind of folks that are, kind of just poking around. But when you start talking about organized crime and potentially, nation-state or, cyber espionage between one company and another, it's a very small investment. There's potential to spend a lot more, and we've seen some hype in the media that certain attacks were nation state sponsored, large teams, multi-million dollars over a couple year period of time, and I think what Dylan's shown here through this project is that he's really pretty much debunked that myth. Now, not to take anything away from Dylan, because he's exceptional.
Right.
He's got great, really, he's one of the top in his field. But it's probably for the general public, it's surprisingly easy to find issues in products, whether they're bugs or vulnerabilities. Easy might not be the right word, but it's definitely not necessarily a $1 million endeavor.
Right, and that gives me a good chance maybe to correct what I said. When I said attackers, I was really thinking more of a researcher trying to attack it. So an independent researcher in his house might not spend $2,000, but that's a trivial sum for someone who actually wants to do something malicious as opposed to is just interested in developing exploit codes and finding vulnerabilities. And I think we have another data point now. You guys have probably seen that Metasploit put out this bounty for exploit modules in Metasploit, and it's amazing what kind of response they're getting in the SCADA world. They're just paying $100 a piece, and they're just flying off the shelves. I mean, people are sending them in. It's almost a race to collect the $100. So it certainly is not a high-ticket item if you want to attack these things. And just one last background question, Dylan. How much time did you devote when you were doing the Siemens research we're going to talk about?
Yeah, so I was juggling three different projects at work, and I did this over a period of 2.5-3 months. And I actually finished my three projects on time. So all in all, I probably spent a little over 2.5 to 3 weeks actually researching and writing code.
With that, let's actually dive into the vulnerabilities now. So why don't you pick one to start with and tell us a little bit about the vulnerability and what the current status of it is in terms of fixes or mitigations from Siemens, in your opinion?
Sure. So one of the issues, we'll start with the web server, right? So Siemens basically came out and said that they now have a feature with their upgraded firmware image that will allow you to disable the web server. And they're basically calling this a patch. And it's not a patch because they haven't actually fixed the problem. They've just given the owner or operator of that PLC and the software the option of disabling it so that the vulnerability can't be triggered.
Just to jump in there, Dylan, so the vulnerability we're talking about here is the one that's listed as a denial of service vulnerability on the S7-1200 PLC that supposedly some sort of scanner, undefined scanner, can cause a denial of service vulnerability?
Yeah, it's not even that. So it's actually a malformed HTTP request that triggers a bug. And the reason that this bug is very important is because it doesn't just put the CPU into a stop state. It actually puts it into a perpetual error state, meaning that the plant owner or operator would have to locate the PLC, power cycle the PLC, and then from there issue a run command to bring the the CPU back into an active state. So really, this isn't setting the controller into stop mode. It's now in a defective state, which can have serious consequences, especially in a large power plant or even a large factory, right, where you have several PLCs spread out throughout the factory. Now you have to locate them and power cycle them and then issue commands to bring it back online. And it's not based on a scanner or sending a bunch of packets to the server. It's a malformed request. So something's going on there with that web server that needs to be patched, and they need to debug it, obviously, find out where that bug is, and then issue a patch so people can fix that. I think the feature of disabling the web server was really just a quick way for people to mitigate the issue, provided they were concerned with that.
That's a valid response. I mean, that's a compensating control. It's certainly not where you want to get to, and it's not really fixing the vulnerability. It's really just a compensating control. Does that vulnerability affect the 300 or 400 PLC?
No.
Okay, so that's just on the S7-1200. Any other points on that vulnerability you think the listener should know?
No.
Yeah, that one seems relatively straightforward, probably a good one to start with.
Yeah.
So maybe let's dive now into the replay attack, because that one seems to be a lot more chewy.
Sure. Yeah, so one of the issues I found during my research was that ISO/TSAP packets aren't encrypted or obfuscated in any other way than the access portion of the TCP stream that's sent by the client. There's a memory protection feature in the Step 7 engineering software that basically allows you to take a clear text password, generate a hash, right? There's a session with that, and you basically send an authentication packet following another probe, which will flip a bit in the PLC memory to enable that protection. So when I came to Siemens and addressed the issue with the packet forging and replay attack, they said, oh, well, we have a mitigation effort for that. All you have to do, right, is enable this memory protection feature. And again, like I said, within 45 minutes, I was able to bypass that. I knew that that feature was flawed because of the issue they had with the actual replay attack itself, or as they put it, the replay gap. And again, one of the issues there is that there's no sort of session expiration or true authentication factor that's being used there. You're literally just capturing an authentication packet and replaying that. So the PLC doesn't know the difference between a rogue packet or a legitimate packet. And it's quite concerning, really, when you think about it, because that feature in and of itself is the only solution that I know of that prevents unauthorized access to the device. It makes it trivial for an attacker to exploit that weakness.
So you've talked a lot about replay here. Have you looked at all at the ability of inserting your own command rather than just replaying commands that you've recorded?
Yes, I have.
Any idea as to how hard or how easy that would have been or would be?
Very trivial, very easy, very simple.
So the authentication that's attached to the message that you're replaying wouldn't be hard to recreate with a different write packet or some sort of diagnostic packet if you chose to?
That's correct.
Okay, and then one other related thing to that is it came out in the bulletin quite a bit that they really emphasized that it had to be sent to the same PLC. So if you recorded information sent to a PLC, could you do it to another PLC?
Absolutely not true. And if you look at the new security advisory that came out that was published on Friday, it says here, in the first case, it was possible to record communication between the engineering software and the controller using available open source tools and transmit the communication to the controller at a later time. This makes it possible to carry out the same actions, again, set the controller to stop mode, which were previously performed on the controller by the engineering software. This is true whether or not the controller is password protected, period. Then it goes on to say, with the new firmware, this will no longer be possible once the password is configured. And then it goes on to say, it is not, however, possible to replay the recorded data obtained from one controller to another controller within the same plant or other plants as long as they are configured with unique passwords. So they're going on the assumption right, that the attacker does not already have the pre-recorded authentication packet, which could be generated. You look at how AirCrackNG works, right? So if you're able to generate these authentication packets, it's only a matter of time before you're going to get into the PLC, right? So if you perform a man-in-the-middle attack, for instance, and capture an authentication packet, or you generate your own authentication packets and then compare them to what you captured while you were inside of this quote-unquote air-gap network, right, you could easily crack the authentication mechanism. So there's a whole other issue here with a weak hashing algorithm, right? And, of course, because I don't have access to their source code, I can't really go into much detail on that, but the authentication mechanism that was inherently flawed by design that is still on these controllers, right, presumably it's on the 300 and 400 as well, right, is broken. It needs to be fixed.
It's broken in the sense that you've gone through it and you've found a way to crack it? Okay.
That is correct.
So have you actually gone as far as trying to put a program in the PLC that you own and actually try to write, let's say, a rogue write command or a rogue read command to the device?
Yes, and that is quite possible. I have done that, and I have demonstrated that for ICS CERT.
Did you go so far to actually reverse engineer the protocol a little bit, like, so you went in and actually understood the protocol and then used that? I guess let me ask that another way. Since you've done this work, what have you been doing in terms of building exploit tools around this?
Well, again, I mean, it's really hard to quantify the amount of different sort of attack scenarios that one could come up with. Use your imagination. I mean, you can do anything you can do with the Step 7 engineering software now with Metasploit, right, depending on the packet library you have access to. So I have a packet library that I have not shared with Siemens that contains a number of different packets that will allow me to manipulate the operational logic on the controller itself. But I can do more than that. I can change a password. So I can lock you out of your own PLC, right? I can change the IP address on the PLC. I can change the MAC address on the PLC. I can change the serial number on the PLC. So it's more than just flipping a few different bits in memory. There's a lot of information that you can extract from the device, and you can also write that information back to the device, provided you have the right packet library and you already have this stuff pre-compiled and put into your framework. So, and that's kind of what I've been working on for the last couple of months as well, is creating this huge packet library.
Now, I want to get into the patch in a little bit, but just to play devil's advocate a little bit here, a lot of the PLCs, RTUs, and other controllers in this space essentially lack any authentication. So if you are on the network, you're able to do a lot of the things that you set. You're able to write commands. You're able to dump logs. You're able to change configuration. You can do all that sort of thing.
Define for me what you mean by being on the network, because if I were to take the same exploit code and put it into a worm, I wouldn't physically have to be on the network. If I could convince someone to take some removable media, such as a thumb drive, right, I could design a worm that would scan for port 102, ISO/TSAP, find all the PLCs that are connected, read the serial number from the PLC, and then target my attack based off of that identifier.
Right. And the work you've done, I think, is really good and strong and needed. I'm just trying to understand how different it is for Siemens as for others. Because, for example, I don't know if you saw it a couple years ago, Daniel Peck, one of my guys back then, sort of did a subset of what you did for the Rockwell Automation Control Logics, where they had a unauthenticated firmware upload feature, and he was able to upload his own firmware there and develop a little worm that scanned for the Ethernet IP port and then, you know, go ahead and propagate. So it's a problem in a lot of controllers, and I'm just trying to understand, is the problem here that they have some security built into the protocol that in fact isn't very effective, or is there something else I'm missing there?
Well, there's no security built into the protocol whatsoever. They have a feature, right, that they claim in their defense in depth model, and then they have this memory protection, which doesn't work. And again, that's a part of the PLC itself and the Step 7 software, right? So everything inside of the packets essentially is in clear text. Mm-hmm. It's not encrypted,
right?
Not secure, meaning that anybody can intercept that and then manipulate that and create their own packet to attack that PLC.
if you had a nice authentication algorithm around that and you didn't really care if they saw the data, that would be sufficient as well, I assume, right? If you...
Yeah, and maybe a session that expired, actually. You know, one that had an actual expiration on it. You can only use this one time. And if you try to use it twice, I'm going to reject it. Yeah, it amazes me that the sessions don't expire. And there is a session in there. If you capture some traffic, look at the DCP stream, you'll find the session. It's in clear text, and it doesn't expire. Now, it does change, right? It's not the same the next time you send the same traffic back to the PLC. But again, if you have a pre-recorded session, you can play that against any S7-1200, provided it came from the S7-1200, right? So all you need are the right packets. You have the packets, you can craft them and create your attack based off of that.
So then let's talk a little bit, and Rick, maybe this is where you can get involved a little bit too, in terms of the Siemens relationship here. You found these vulnerabilities. They have issued a patch with some kind of limited information about what it does and what it fixes. Rick, does NSS Labs have any interaction at this point with Siemens in terms of when they have a patch, they send it to you guys to say, hey, does this fix the problem you found, or is there any relationship there?
Yeah, we had been in conversations with them afterwards. We had obviously provided them with just tons of intelligence and support, you know, around up to previously to the time of the takedown conference, and then, you know, even after that. But they, there is no relationship at this point. I would say that they released their patch on their own. We didn't get a heads up or a copy of the patch. We found out the same time everyone else in the world did. So. You know, there is no relationship. They're certainly welcome to do that, you know, to, you know, interact with us at least in some level, but, I guess they've chosen not to do so.
Yeah, it's funny because you see all different sorts, but in our experience, when we found things, oftentimes the patch fixes maybe a symptom, but not the underlying problem. And it takes a couple of go arounds. So it's always, I guess my advice to a vendor would be always if you've got some relationship that's decent, to try to send the patch out there and let the researcher see if it actually fixes it. So maybe Dylan, throwing it back to you, have you looked at the patch and does it actually fix the problem?
So I'm in the process of validating the patch right now. In fact, I will tell you, based off of what I've seen in the advisory and the recommendations that Siemens is giving to its customers, I'm not entirely comfortable with this patch. I'm still waiting on the actual patch to come out, which really fixes the problems, as opposed to just recommending that people turn off certain features. And then they really haven't fixed very much, to be honest with you. So, yes, I am in the process of validating the patch. And I will validate it. I've read the alert from ICS CERT, which, mind you, ICS CERT did not release an advisory. It was only an alert. They said that they have validated each patch. So, and that, in fact, the first patch that they received, Siemens actually introduced a new bug, a new vulnerability into that patch. So they had to go back and work on it some more. So CERT did a really good thing there in terms of finding the new bug, which, again, that does happen during the process of creating patches. New bugs are introduced into the firmware images. So that's why it took them a little bit of time, I think, for this first initial release. But, again, I don't even know if I feel comfortable really calling it a patch just yet.
Okay, so that sounds like it's a stay tuned at this point.
Yeah.
Now, you did give one...
I don't think we'd be...
Go ahead.
I don't think we'd be recommending that folks run out and... Right. Buy the patch right away at this stage. There's certainly a lot more complex assessment
You bring up a very good point. The patch is available for free, but you can't actually patch the PLC unless you have the Somatic S7 proprietary memory card, which has a very special Siemens format. So you can't just use any regular card. You've got to buy their micro memory card, and you have to use that card, which costs you almost as much as the S7 controller is worth itself. I think the 1200 goes for about $500 and the memory card's around $400. So that's another issue I have with the whole patching process. The fact that you now have to buy an additional piece of hardware to patch the PLC.
Well, Rick, I want to go back to your comment there because that was interesting to me. That's probably not a typical stance, is it, that you would say, let's say Adobe or somebody puts out a patch, the normal reaction would be maybe you don't want to be the first one to patch because there could be an issue with the patch causing a problem, a compatibility issue. But usually the benefit of the doubt is that it's going to fix the problem. But it sounds like in this case, or maybe you always feel this way. Can you elaborate a little more why you would not necessarily run out and tell people to put this patch on?
Well, I mean, a couple of reasons. One, I think in the IT space where you have companies like Adobe and Microsoft that have long-standing traditions of having released many patches and have well-defined processes and communities that and ecosystems around that. They've made their mistakes in the past, and there's a lot of learning that they've done. There's a lot of eyes on those patches. In this case, this particular patch is fairly fresh out. Again, I would defer to Dylan's hands-on assessment of it, and I know that there are a lot more intricacies in applying the patch to any number of devices manually with a flash card that an operator might have in their environment. So, and the potential that there might be additional patches down the road to address the other issues that weren't fixed with this version. I think, from an operator standpoint, you need to look at, the operational cost and the risk and how your network is actually configured. Everything should be risk-driven. So we often see that folks don't go out and deploy all the patches ASAP because it's logistically impossible or cost prohibitive. So there should be some planning and assessment done. I think operators also need to look at how their networks are configured. If they, truly have an air-gapped network, then there's probably more leeway and time that they can wait before applying the patches. If they're not using certain services, that would come into consideration. The implementation will certainly depend.
Yeah, that's a really good point in terms of the timing, especially if you think another patch is coming out. Patching these PLCs is a whole new world for most of our SCADA and DCS owner-operators, and something they probably are not going to want to do very often. So that really makes a lot of sense. If you think there's going to be another patch coming out in the next 1 to 3 months, maybe you don't want to run out and put this one on. I'm speaking with Rick Moy. He is the CEO of NSS Labs, and Dylan Beresford with NSS Labs. He's a security analyst there and the person who found a number of Siemens vulnerabilities. And I really appreciate the time, guys. I just had a couple other quick questions for you. Dylan, you did actually make a minor presentation, I guess, down in Austin because one of our alumni, Kevin Lackey, attended it. And in his report, he said something about getting shell on a PLC or root access to the OS. Was there anything behind those comments, or can you put any context to that little blurb he put out there?
Not at this time. Again, that is to be disclosed at Black Hat. I will tell you that it's possible, yes.
Okay. Let me try another one here. Some of the public information on the vulnerabilities, the web server vulnerability came out, the PLC replay attack came out. There's been talk about a memory protection attack. Is that just part of the PLC replay attack, or is that something different?
Absolutely not. So again, because the Step 7 engineering software allows you to enable this feature, right, and because you're able to essentially read and write from memory into memory, right, by again having those packets inside of a packet library, you can send a command back to the PLC to disable that protection feature. And it's literally a bit flipping sequence that takes place. So provided you have the right packet, you can disable the memory protection feature on the PLC. And now here's why it's really concerning is because the operator looking at the Step 7 software isn't going to see any changes, right? It's still going to look like the PLC is protected, right? Because you're not attacking Step 7 software. You're attacking the Somatic S7 PLC. And that of itself, right, you shouldn't be able to flip that bit or write to memory remotely without having access to the Step 7 engineering machine as well as the right credentials. So that in and of itself is a different vulnerability. The one mitigation effort they do have in place to prevent the replay attack doesn't work because it can be disabled remotely by an attacker.
You know, it sounds eerily familiar to some of the things that Ralph wrote about Stuxnet, that they were always talking about how the engineering workstation was compromised by all these 0 days, and that was used then to attack the PLCs. And he's always said, well, it wasn't really necessary to even have an engineering workstation. If you were just on the same IP network and could get unfettered access to that interface on the PLC, that was sufficient. And it sounds similar to what you're saying there.
I agree. I agree with Mr. Langner on that. In fact, what we saw with Stuxnet was that essentially it was pivoting off of the engineering workstation, whereas with my attacks, you're attacking the PLC directly.
That's really important because I know if you've listened to any of the previous podcasts, things like whitelisting and host IPS on engineering workstations and HMI are getting a lot of buzz, and I think there's some value to those solutions, but they're not going to necessarily prevent you from attacking the PLC because, like you said, you can go directly to it.
That's correct.
And I'll add, Dale, that's one of the things I meant to add in terms of the assessment, that there are certainly security product strategies that figure into the scenario here, whether they're host-based, anti-malware, whitelisting, or network-based data diodes or firewalls, IPS-type technologies. And that's right in the wheelhouse of what NSS Labs does for evaluating the effectiveness of these types of products. So folks can expect to see more research from us along those lines. But, you know, so now you've got these vulnerable target systems. How effective are the various mitigation strategies and products?
Right, but I do like it. It seems like NSS Labs is taking a dual-track approach, and maybe it's just wishful thinking on my part, but we've got a large deployed base that is going to take a long time to upgrade or patch and probably needs compensating controls. But on the other hand, these compensating controls shouldn't mean that the vendor doesn't have to fix the underlying problem. So it sounds like you're holding their feet to the fire and potentially looking at possible solutions for the interim if they don't fix it or people can't patch it soon enough.
That's a really good point I wanted to address because ultimately it does come back to the vendor, right? Just like you can test seat belts and airbags, but if they aren't built into the cars, there's little use for them. And just like in IT, right, where you have, you know, static and dynamic code analysis in the software development lifecycle, you know, that same approach needs to apply to industrial control systems. It's really no different. It's a software engineering effort that's coupled to very tightly with hardware. So the vendors do need to really grow and kind of evolve their approach to involve more of a security component in not just to deliver functionality. And that's right. That's a whole learning curve that still is, from my perspective, trailing the traditional IT space.
Yeah, so funny you mentioned that, Rick. When I spoke with the CERT team at Siemens, some of their security engineers had never used Metasploit. They were still getting up to speed with Nmap, and there were a variety of tools that I mentioned that they had never used before. So there was a meeting that I had with them over the phone where I walked them through using Metasploit as well as a few other tools that are out there. So I find that quite interesting that they didn't have experience with some of the tools that are freely available and open source.
And maybe I can just run one more point off of that then. So you're talking about all these discussions you've had and the work you've done and the things that you provided to Siemens, and that was all just pro bono, right? That's here's information you should know, Siemens. Here's how you can do it. Here's how you can learn.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
That's correct. We've never received or asked for any compensation from Siemens.
And I'm not suggesting necessarily that that's right or wrong, but it's just one of these things that sometimes people in the community, especially the owner-operators less familiar with vulnerability research, don't understand that there's actually a fair amount of work involved, not only in finding it, but then in communicating with the vendor. And there's no oftentimes there's no money in that. So it's really just trying to do the right thing and hoping that the vendor will do the right thing through your efforts, which I think is really great. Well, just to finish off then, guys, I want to, Dylan, I'll start with you. Is there any other, I guess, class of vulnerability or thing we should be looking for or misstatement that you think needs to be corrected out there about what you've done? I kind of an all-encompassing wrap-up question for you.
At this point in time, I'd like to see an advisory come out by ICS CERT with a little more clarity. And I'd like to see Siemens retract some of the statements they've made in their summary as well as the description. Again, they reported that that ICS CERT notified them about two weaknesses in the Symantec S7-1200 CPU product, and that's not true at all. So, I mean, again, we've gone over a number of different vulnerabilities and different attack scenarios, and I think that they need to go back and recalibrate their description as well as some of the mitigation recommendations they made and their solution in their advisory, which is what I'm looking at right now.
Just to be clear, when you say two is not correct, it was a larger number than two.
That is correct.
So there were more than two, and that's one of the things you'd like to see, I guess, corrected and maybe more detail provided about the others at the appropriate time. And Rick, I just as CEO of NSS Labs, I want to thank you for sponsoring this type of pro bono work with some of the talent you have down there at your organization. It's the kind of things that just don't get done unless somebody pays for it. So I really appreciate you encouraging your staff and giving them a little seed money to buy some equipment. I think it's great. Are there any takeaway thoughts on this whole Siemens vulnerability effort that you'd want to leave us with?
Well, first of all, we're happy to do this type of work. It's in our blood. We can't help it, for better or worse. And it's certainly work that needs to be done. I think that in terms of ICS-related vulnerabilities, we're just really at the beginning of the curve. I'm hopeful and optimistic that different elements of the community can rally together and put some momentum together about addressing the vulnerabilities that are already inherent in our systems and bringing some more security into the life cycle. This is not a one-time occurrence, finding some vulnerabilities. I'm sure these and others exist in many other products that have yet to be found, and I think it's going to take quite a long time and dedication from many players to improve it.
Great. That's a great last word, and I've gotten a few emails from people who have said, this issue seems to be reaching critical mass, and if not now, when will it be fixed? So I'm hopeful that we're getting close to getting there. And I want to thank you both for being on the podcast with me. I had Dylan Beresford and Rick Moy, both with NSS Labs. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Dill.
You're listening to the June 2011 edition of Digital Bonds, This Month in Control System Security. This Month in Control System Security is sponsored by Waterfall Security Solutions. Sleep better at night. Waterfall's unidirectional gateways absolutely prevent access to your critical assets. Waterfall's security gateways make compliance with NERC, SIP, CFATS, NIST, and other regulations easy, while preventing essential real-time data flows. Join security leaders in many industries who have discovered strong security in unidirectional gateways. Learn more at waterfall-security.com. Schweitzer Engineering Labs, SEL Cybersecurity Solutions, sensible, manageable, scalable at selinc.com/cybersecurity. And by Nitro Security. Nitro Security is a leader in security event management and compliance solutions for industrial control systems. Learn more at nitrosecurity.com.
Joining the This Month in Control System Security podcast now is Rick Kahn. He is with Matricon. Hi, Rick.
How you doing, Dale?
Great. And I've been wanting to have you on the podcast for a while because I've been a big fan of the open letters that you and Matricon have been putting out about what's happening with SIP. It's so much work to track not only the current SIP in terms of how it's being applied and some of the judgments being made on the current SIP, but then we've got version 4 under work, version 5 under work, so it's a lot of things to track, and I find that your open letters are the best resource out there. Maybe to start, can you give us an idea as to what kind of effort you're making or how you're going about staying current on SIP today and SIP in the future?
Great question, and thanks, Dale, by the way, for the plug. We take great pride in those open letters, and they've been very well received. We've actually had the chair of the drafting committee follow them as well and say, you know, good synopsis, you're helping to educate, because I think that they find the committee as well as people close to the process find that it is a very fast-moving stream and keeping track of things is difficult. So any and every effort to educate and share the word is welcome. So,
well, one thing on that, we'll include a link in the show notes, but how would they get those open letters if they wanted to read them?
The easiest way would be if you went to my blog at insecurity.matricon.com. We always have links to there. You can search on NERC SIP, or you could go to matricon.com/security. Both cases, they're posted. I think the marketing people on our side insist that we have sort of a logon for tracking and prevention of spam and website scraping. But if you don't like either of those and want to be a little more anonymous, you can contact Dale if you don't mind my throwing yours out, Dale, and you'll throw them my way or me directly at rick.con@honeywell.com. We have been acquired now. But any of those three options, our website, our blog, or just email me if you want to talk direct to the source.
Great. And there is no charge for registering. So these are free. They just require registration, much like some of the tools on our site do.
Absolutely. They're all free. They're in the public domain. It's just capture of what happened in a meeting. It's just a matter of security and tracking controls. It is free, yes.
So let's go back then. What kind of effort are you putting forth, you and your team, to stay abreast of what's going on with SIP?
So the first and foremost effort that we do in that space is I have at least one person, sometimes an alternate, actually attend the standard drafting team committee meetings. They are open meetings. Anyone in the public can attend them. We as an organization trying to help our clients through the heads or tails of this felt that the more information we could get right from the source, the better. So it actually started as us trying to help and make our service better and our performance for our clients better. And it turned into a very popular, town crier almost, as it were, you know, reporter in the field thing that our guy goes to, pays close attention, takes copious notes, and then we try and boil it down into heads or tails and put it into what you're seeing as the open letters. So we do actually vet a lot of that, though. I mean, the first format is obviously the standard drafting team meetings. The second, though, is we try and vet a lot of that information and meet some of the same usual suspects when they're speaking and attend different user group, like the SIP user group that WEC puts on and other industry initiatives in those spaces to kind of double-check our homework and socialize some of these things and get feedback on the open letters.
Well, they are very useful because I know we tried to track SIP closely for a while there and just, I don't know if it was lack of interest on our part or we got overwhelmed, but at some point we really just started focusing on some of the technical things and got out of all the process work. So we do really appreciate the open letters. So maybe, why don't we look at it this way? Let's jump right to the end. Based on what you're seeing in the latest meetings and other information you're gathering, where do you see SIP going in version 4 and version 5? What should our listeners really know and expect in the future?
Yeah, that's a big question with lots of potential ramifications. But I think if you wanted to read the tea leaves and see the general direction, the idea is that the intent of the NERC SIP and post-blackout is the bulk electric system needs a better security baseline. And so notwithstanding the various arguments and ramifications of current versions and pending versions, the couple of the biggest themes that are trying to be addressed, the first is that there's not enough participation today amongst the grid and components of the grid in the standard. So what they're trying to do is strengthen the language with an eye towards having at least a base-level security program pretty much everywhere on the grid. So to that end, versions 4 and 5 start to introduce. Version 4 was, of course, the Brightline criteria, which said fairly explicitly, if you have this many megawatts or this many volts on a line, you know, for transmission or generation, you're in scope because there was too much ambiguity in previous versions. The other thing they're trying to do is get a little more specific on the granularity of the controls. And really, version 5, if you fast forward from version 4, trying to get more of the high-impact people with the Brightline criteria appendix. Version 5 is really actually starting to put the placeholder and the foundation for a minimum security profile across everything, and then those that are considered higher impact or higher criticality have the full-blown security controls. So really, the premise of the standard, its first intent, is to get more of the grid in scope and playing along. The second major theme that I started with is the current version of the standard, which I'm sure we'll get into more later, there are some issues with it in terms of its interpretation and applicability in a real-world environment. So they're trying to not only get more people to participate, but they're trying to make the participation make more sense and be more reasonable and realistic.
On the participation front and the bright line you mentioned, that's the SIP 2 version 4, where, as you said, specific criteria for making something a critical cyber asset is in place. Now, I think in your last open letter, there was some talk that maybe FERC wasn't satisfied with where that bright line was, or where there was some concern or issue with maybe that line not being strict enough, that more assets needed to be in there. Has there been any up?
Remember, yeah, this is our interpretation of FERC's request. They put in an actual request for more information from NERC. And the issue there, our interpretation was that the original Brightline criteria, and by the way, if anyone's looking for it, it's the data request docket RM11-11-000. We can provide you that link, Dale, for later. The FERC requested clarification on a number of the things that NERC had offered. And the history is this. NERC had done a survey of its members, its utility owners and operators, and came up with this sort of scenario as to what they thought would be in scope or what they would assume would eventually in version 5 be considered a high-impact facility. They then drafted, they meaning NERC, drafted a standard around that basic premise. There was significant pushback from the committee or from the audience, and the mandate of NERC is that if there are negative votes, they need to address them, or negative comments along with the vote, they need to be addressed and the standard revamped. So NERC revamped a second and then eventually a third time to get approval, and FERC's concern is because the original survey was done prior to amendments, that the amendments have boiled down potentially the scope, and therefore the original survey results are no longer valid.
Now, this revamping that you're talking about, when the initial versions didn't pass the vote and they went second version, third version, did that make the bright line, I guess, more lenient, so fewer assets would be fall, I guess, above that bright line?
Well, potentially, right? See, because what happened was the first version of the language, as is usually happened when it's edited by committee, many, many people took very specific interpretations and demanded clarification and qualification of different lines and segments and numbers. So I think what happened was that the results of the survey changed because the language changed, but the question is, and which is why FERC is asking it, is did the numbers, the original numbers that would fall into high impact and therefore come into play, increase or did it decrease? And remember, FERC is very much pushing for there to be a much higher participation in this. And in fact, if you go to that blog, I don't remember if it's on my blog or my Twitter account, but I remember seeing an article where Congress stood up and said the power industry is not secure enough, and pointed at FERC, who then pointed at NERC. So there's a lot of impetus to get more of the high impact and the bigger facilities up and running and into scope. I mean, it's the stats are maybe a little bit old, but not a lot of people have jumped on board and adding facilities just yet. When version 3 was just done, WEC produced some statistics, which are available on their website, that only about 17% of the grid in their space was actually doing anything about the standard. And if you look at the original intent, like we talked at the beginning of this, the idea is to have a security baseline across the whole grid so that there's a much more reliable power supply. And we all know that 83% of the grid can't possibly go away and us still function. So how is it that 83% of the grid is not participating in the standard?
Good point. And it's funny, this is anecdotal evidence, which always is dangerous. But in some of our clients, we've noticed where they thought they had to comply with NERC SIP and were planning on it. And then when this bright line came out, they were underneath the bright line. So they did not need to. So we've actually seen cases where the bright line has moved people back. Now, maybe those people were being too conservative originally, but I'm sure that wasn't the intent of that. And I guess one other thing, you know, not being an electric engineer and not really understanding that part of it, we work with servers and workstations and PLCs and such. It's hard for me to judge what would impact the bulk electric system. But it seems like 17%, as you said, would be a pretty small number, and there would have to be more than that that would impact the bulk electric system.
Yeah, and I think a large part, so to your earlier point, yeah, it wasn't intended for facilities that were doing the right thing to necessarily take systems offline or out of the program. And in fact, I was meeting with this very similar situation not long ago, and I tried my best to convince them that, you know what, version 4 with Brightline may knock this facility out, but version 5, where there's a baseline minimum, will put it back in. So turning a program like security, which really needs to be adopted as more of a day-to-day culture in everything that your people do to be able to maintain it, turning it on and off is counterintuitive, and you're just going to go backwards. I mean, if you've already gone through the effort to put it into place, you know, maybe keep it running, use it as a training or practice facility, but eventually, you know, you read the tea leaves, it's going to come everywhere to some level, and to take those off goes backwards. But you're right. The flip side, though, too, I mean, you know, we have a client that said we'll just do it everywhere, and I bet you a lot of their facilities are not going to be in scope version 4. But we also know of utilities that have, you know, next to no participation from their large generation and just subsets of their transmission, which is a very common stance from the first versions of the first adopters of this, and that's what they're trying to push those people along and get them to a more uniform application across a much wider range of their assets and utilities and facilities.
Just from the tone of your voice when you were describing your conversation with the customer, I think you run into what we run into quite often, where you're in an organization and there's a couple people in that organization that have been trying to get out of SIP for quite a while. Maybe not the whole organization, but a couple people at higher levels, and the bright line, if they can stand behind that and say we don't have to do it, is I guess a pretty powerful argument to try to fight back against.
Mm-hmm. It is, and you're right. There's still pockets of people out there who are finding a clause like the routable protocol clause, which is intended to go away as well, and saying, oh well, I'll just pull this plug, and that whole facility is no longer critical. And that's, you know, from your, Dale, you're a security guy. I mean, the hard and crunchy on the outside, wide open on the inside isn't really a security model at all. But that's a sense of not accomplishment, but for a lot of people that gives them that out to disclude that facility and what it is they're doing. So,
okay, so let's. I don't want to spend all our time on version 4. So what's the net? When do we expect FERC to either sign off or push back on version 4?
Well, this is where we get into the area of speculation. We were expecting them to sign it of now, June of second quarter of this year. But because it's been pushed back for this data request, they're looking at potentially another 3 to 6 months before they... So either Q3 or Q4, we're looking for approval. Excuse me. After which, then there would be the normal period for those that fall under scope now in the new version to have to come into up to speed. So it will be a while yet before we find out. But we're hoping in either Q3 or Q4 FERC will approve, and then the 18 to 24 month window that was proposed for timing would then kick into place.
Okay, great. Well, let's move on to version 5, because version 5 is actually a little bit more interesting and a bigger departure from the previous versions. Why don't you give us a highlight of maybe some of the major changes we should expect in version 5?
Okay. Well, one of the most interesting things about version 5 is that they're not changing the naming. And I know this sounds trivial, but a lot of people have put a lot of effort and time and money and education into SIP 2 through 9 as a language. So for those who were looking at the next version being potentially SIP 010 or SIP 10 and SIP 11, funny enough, they are going to be part of the next version of SIP, but not as a replacement, not as the fifth version. SIP 10 and 11 take two contentious subjects or fairly detailed subjects within the current standard and split them out into their own discipline. One is security controls like information handling, and the other is change management. So version 5 stays the same name and extends and expands a little bit and gives more clarity. But the other thing is that version 5 also changes some of the concepts to bulk electric system, cyber systems and cyber assets. Changes a little bit around the notion of what we have come to embrace in SIP 5 around electronic security perimeter. But most importantly, SIP 5 talks about that baseline everywhere and then a higher level as being brought in, and SIP 5 also looks at distribution as an extension of what is primarily just transmission and generation being in scope. Distribution also starts to get in there as well.
So if I look at some of your past open letters, you were saying that they've moved from this critical asset, critical cyber asset to BES or bulk electric system, and BES cyber asset. And the definition you had was something that impacts the bulk electric system within 15 minutes?
Yep. So, in fact, right from the letter, if I'll just paraphrase right here, critical asset and critical cyber asset will disappear in V5. These terms will be replaced with the concept of a bulk electric system cyber system and a bulk electric system cyber asset. And these are systems or assets whose loss would impact the BES, the bulk electric system, within 15 minutes. So every system that directly touches the BES, even ones that don't provide control but just situational awareness or read-only viewing, is a likely candidate to be subject to SIP controls in version 5.
So you've talked about these different set of controls. So does that mean we're going to see major differences in SIP 3 through 9 in addition to the SIP 10 and SIP 11 you already talked about? But do you expect 3 through 9 to change quite a bit?
No, there are clarifications in some areas. For example, SIP 5 has an original draft around secure remote access and how you enable it and what's required for proof of it. It didn't pass muster for the current version 4 that's in front of. It didn't pass NERC's ballot process to get put into the package. It was thrown to FERC for version 4. They're hoping to get it done in time since FERC has pushed back approval of version 4 to submit it as an addendum and get version 5 tuned. But they're mostly tweaking and tuning things. Like I said, taking some sections out to 10 and 11, clarifying things in SIP 5, little things here and there. You will see, however, a difference, I think, in some of the measures as they go forward. One of the other hallmarks of the issue, and this gets to our wanting to discuss maybe a little bit about some of the challenges. Some of the issues with the current SIP standard is it's a very binary, you're in compliance or you're not, which doesn't allow for the intent or the effort of a facility. For example, if you have a very large organization that has a lot of people leave their employment or change employment, the access revocation and the paperwork that goes with that in the time frames spelled out is potentially difficult if you had like 1,000 people change employment in the last year. However, if you were a small co-op or a small facility and you had 5 people change employment, you as a small facility are just as culpable having missed 4 out of 5 of your revocations as the large facility who only missed 5 out of their 1,000. So they want to allow for there to be the ability to apply a best effort or an intent measure to the level of compliance as opposed to just simply judging, perfect, you're compliant or you're not. In association with that, they want to allow for there to be an appeals process. So there will be clarifications and expectations in the subsets around the measure and the consequence and the way to do things. But the actual controls are most likely just going to get more clarification. I don't see a whole lot of real significant change, like I said, outside of some of the philosophical back end for measurements. We'll always see small tuning and fine tuning of them over time, I'm sure. But hopefully version 5 will take care of the lion's share of the order 706 and the remediations that FERC originally ordered. And then from there, it just becomes a living document.
Well, that's a little bit of a shame, because I know when we're involved with bulk electric system entities, either doing some SIP vulnerability assessments or other work, there's a fair amount of the work that is very labor-intensive that doesn't really provide a whole lot of risk reduction. It seems to be, you know, highly inefficient if you're trying to secure a system, in this case, you know, a SCADA or DCS that's part of the bulk electric system. And I guess one of the areas that always drives us crazy is this, we run into it with the SIP7 vulnerability assessment, that you have to have a list of every service running on every cyber asset and then check that as part of the vulnerability assessment. And these aren't services that are on exposed ports. These are just services running on the device. I wouldn't go so far as to say there's no value in that, but compared to a lot of the other things that they could be doing in their cybersecurity program, it seems like quite a waste of time to go through for hundreds of assets manually checking, you know, every service in a big spreadsheet. But you say they're not really looking at that sort of thing, saying, is this really getting us risk reduction? Is this a valid control to put in place to maximize risk reduction?
Yeah, and you know what? I think the specific example you gave, I can't comment on. I'm not close enough to the process myself. But I would suspect that those types of languages are exactly, and having seen similar ones in the past, are exactly the types of comments or negative objections they normally get when they put these standards out there. So I would suspect that over time those things become more refined, and that options, opportunities like that become more realistic. Because one of the underlying complaints that I hear at many of the conferences we go to is that there are facilities that are doing what is required for compliance, but in some cases it's actually not any more secure, and in some cases even less secure potentially what they were doing or what they intend to do, because it's what they were doing versus what they're supposed to do is different, and what you're supposed to do is what gets the attention and the penalties potentially.
Yeah, it's very difficult, because when you get in these arguments, you can't say there's zero value in knowing all the services on your machine, on all the systems, and tracking them. There is some value there. It's just, are you getting an efficient set of risk reduction for the effort you're putting in there, as opposed to putting it in somewhere else? And it almost ties to my friend Richard Baitlick is always talking about APT. You know, when he was at GE, he used to say that they don't even try to secure everything to the highest level. You know, they look at what is really important and put their emphasis there, because it's a losing battle trying to treat everything the same.
Absolutely, and that gives rise to some of the issues they have. Is that, I mean, you look at one of the biggest issues they have right now is the filing of what they call TFEs, technical feasibility exceptions. That's where the intent of thou shalt load, for example, thou shalt load antivirus on everything, obviously doesn't happen on a switch or a firewall. What's the value in having an entity file the TFE and maintain that paperwork over the life cycle of the plant for the inability to put antivirus on a system that never will probably host antivirus?
So how are they addressing that?
So what they're looking to do is they're looking, so this is to your point, some of the language that, like I said, the specifics I'm not personally aware of, but I know that there is an intent to change them. For example, instead of saying for passwords, and again, this is from one of our open letters, it's in one of the open letters, is instead of the new language they're proposing for password complexity, for example, is for BES cyber systems or components, for those that support passwords of 8 or more characters, password shall be at least 8 characters in length. They're not saying has to be, and they're giving that out where they say for those that support it. So if your system doesn't support it, you can now not have to file the TFE necessarily. You need to be aware that you want to try and increase that complexity or that security control and subsequent upgrades and whatnot. But for now, if it doesn't work, it just doesn't work. You don't have to file a whole pile of paperwork around it.
There's one last area I'd like to hit, Rick, and that's this, I think we mentioned it, but we didn't really get into it, this talk of BES assets that will be, or best cyber assets that will be called high impact. What are they looking to, or how is it going to be structured where they'll put additional security controls on these high impact assets?
That's what I'm actually really curious to see, and see some of the controls when they release the draft of those efforts. The drafting team does work on things publicly at the meetings openly, but they do also have a number of subcommittees that go and write their information, bring it back to the general population. I'm very curious to see how that is, because actually, if you note in the details so far, the intention is that the current SIP language, 3 through 9, for controls is actually intended to be the baseline, not necessarily the high control. So really, if you look at the SIP 3 through 9 standard today and say that a high impact is going to be more strict than that, and as you and I have gone over in this discussion, that's already problematic in a lot of cases. What exactly does that higher level look like? Now, we could speculate, a lot of their network monitoring is thou shalt have logs and check them at least once a week. Well, a higher level of control could be you should have an active CSIRT team monitoring your stuff live and escalate more quickly. I mean, who knows? Some of the more sophisticated security practices around intrusion testing or penetration testing around annual assessments, as opposed to, like you say, simply enumerating all ports and services. For me, it's a bit of speculation. I look forward to seeing what it's all about. But for those who think the SIP 2 through 9 or 3 through 9 is fairly prescriptive and maybe difficult to run up against, I suggest you have a look at how SIP 3 through 9 stacks up against the NIST 853. One of the U.S.-funded research labs did an analysis of the two of them, and I'm pretty sure I could dig it out for you if you want, Dale, to post the link or the content. It showed NERC SIP as a fairly small subset of controls that are in the NIST standard, and some of the rumors I've heard, and I preface that with rumors, are that the SIP standards are potentially going to eventually move towards a NIST type of standard. So maybe we need to look to the 853 for what the high-level control is going to look like.
That's a whole other can of worms. I know my friend Joe Weiss has been pushing for that for a number of years. But it's funny that they're looking that way when 853 has kind of become a failure in the government. The government is moving away from it, saying it's unworkable. We keep showing that it's unworkable after years of experience. I've always found it odd that this community, at least a number of people, are pushing in the 800-53 direction when it's been, I guess, much short of a success and some would say a failure in its implementation in the last, I don't know how long it's been around, but at least 5-10 years or so.
Yeah. No, and I cringe to think of the application of 853 in these environments, especially when you look at power. I mean, there are those that are, there are some very forward-thinking, well-funded companies, but there's a lot of industry in the grid that has a lot of legacy equipment and has a lot of, let's just keep it running, keep it out there, and they're not necessarily investing the way that some other industries, like the oil and gas or petrochemical do, or have been able to. And so the leap from where they are today, and in many cases, which is next to nothing, to a NIST 853, which is much more prescriptive and arguably unworkable, is a recipe for disaster.
Well, that's great. Thank you again, Rick Kahn with Honeywell Advanced Solutions. Rick, why don't you give our listeners one more time your blog and where they can get these open letters?
Love to. It's insecurity. It's http://insecurity.matricon.com. insecurity.matricon.com. And our website for now is still matricon.com/security. But again, if you want to talk to me, it's rick.kahn, K-A-U-N, at honeywell.com. And I think, Dale, we have each other's blogs on each other's sites. If not, I'll send you my link. And I'm also on Twitter if you want. That's how Dale and I communicate fairly often. And, Dale, I truly appreciate the opportunity to share this subject with you and your listeners, and look forward to working more closely with you and your guys and as we go forward in this space, because I think it's a market that's it's just starting to heat up and it's starting to become on everyone's minds, and there's a lot of years of work ahead for everybody.
That's great. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
Well, that's the show for June 2011. I want to thank my guests again, Rick Moy and Dylan Beresford of NSS Labs, and Rick Kahn of Matricon/Honeywell Analytics. This month in Control System Security is sponsored by Schweitzer Engineering Labs. SEL designs powerful and manageable user-based access controls for both serial and Ethernet control system networks. Learn more about the SEL3025 SCADA Shield and the SEL3620 Ethernet Security Gateway or other SEL security products today at selinc.com/cybersecurity. Nitro Security, the leader in security event management and compliance solutions for industrial control systems at nitrosecurity.com. And by Waterfall Security Solutions, security for industrial control networks at waterfall-security.com. As always, we appreciate any comments on this podcast and suggestions for future interviews or other segments for future podcasts. You can send those to us at info@digitalbond.com. That's it for now. We'll see you next month on This Month in Control System Security.